I will to my Lord be true and faithful, and love all which he loves, and shun all which he shuns. That's an Anglo-Saxon oath of fealty. Feudalism, Beowulf, King Arthur, barbarians, Vikings, and conquest. What do we really know about the Anglo-Saxons? I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
We have a tendency to romanticize Anglo-Saxon history. Who were the Angles and the Saxons? And how do we distinguish between myth and history? Were the Anglo-Saxons Christian or pagan? Were they more violent than people today? And where does King Arthur fit into the history of this period? Joining us to explore romancing the Anglo-Saxon past is John Niles, professor of English at the UW-Madison and the current president of the International Society of Anglo-Saxonists.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you very much, Norman. It's good to be here.
Well, I gather we're talking about a fairly broad period, a fairly diverse group of people when we talk about the Anglo-Saxons, but I can't help starting with a question about if we were to encounter, coming out of the fog perhaps today, an Anglo-Saxon man and woman, what would they look like?
That's a good question. They'd probably look pretty much like you or me, dressed in their own style. I'm rather stumped by the question.
Men fashionable to be bearded, or were they, in terms of their physique, were they comparable to us, or would they have been of shorter stature?
Well, it's hard to generalize about these things because, again, it's a complicated thing when we speak of the Anglo-Saxons. There is a racial stereotype of the Anglo-Saxons that was particularly promulgated during the great period of European racialism, the 19th century. And according to that stereotype, they were all handsome, blue-eyed fellows and lovely women, healthy in their physique and so forth, those who survived infancy, that is. And generally, a sort of idealization of all that was admired in those circles about the human physique at that time. In fact, who were the Anglo-Saxons? Well, they were the people living in Britain in a certain historical period. And contemporary genetic research is inclined to lead us to believe that these were the descendants of people who had lived there long before these more Germanic types, as they are idealized, had ever come upon the scene. So there was a very strong indigenous population of British who were probably not like that stereotype in the least. To be Anglo-Saxon meant to accept a certain identity as a law-abiding member of that community, to speak the English language as well. That was the great common denominator. In the later period, to be Christian. But other than that, ethnically, they were very diverse. So that's why I was stumped by your initial question for a moment.
Well, let's set the stage, too, just sort of geographically and also in time. If we're talking about the Anglo-Saxons, are we looking at roughly, the 5th century, 6th century? Where do we begin? And if we imagine England, what we now know as England, what was there? And who were these people?
Well, the story really begins with the collapse of Roman colonial rule in Britain and with the sort of power vacuum that was created with the departure of the Roman legions in particular. And at that time, opportunistic groups under chieftains coming from who knows where exactly, but certainly from the areas now known as northern Germany and southern Scandinavia, such parties came in and carved out areas of control, these eventually emerging into kingdoms and so forth.
How did they even know that there was this power vacuum? It always intrigues me where, because obviously they're not sending Twitters and texting about, the Romans are gone now, there's a vacuum.
The soldiers stopped coming?
Yeah, how did word spread that there was this opportunity?
Word would have spread, I think, rapidly and easily because of the way in which the communities of this period were knit with one another in a complex network of trade and other relationships. The Romans defended the Saxon shore, what they called the Saxon shore, against the people of that particular region, and yet they also hired mercenaries from that region, as they hired mercenaries coming from all over Europe to serve in their army and navy. And these people had cousins and friends, and again, there was commerce between them. So I think that wasn't a problem in that time. There wouldn't have been instant telegraphic communication, but the network of communications was, I think, thick and close.
You mentioned the indigenous British populations. Who were they, and was it that easy to knock them over for these invading Angles and Saxons and Jutes?
Well, who the native British were is, again, another complex question. We think of them as being Celtic in origin, but in fact there was a very considerable indigenous population long before Celtic-speaking peoples ever arrived in the British Isles in what we refer to as the Bronze Age. Witness the great monuments at Stonehenge and Avebury and Newgrange in Ireland. It took very complex, well-organized, well-manned societies with an agricultural base to produce these centers. So, again, there is a heritage from an indigenous population that should never be neglected. As far as how easy they were to knock over, as it were, well, the traditional story, going back to the Venerable Bede, who wrote his ecclesiastical history of the English people around the year, he completed it about the year 731 AD, is that, yes, the Angles and the Saxons, being a warlike and rather ruthless people, came to Britain soon after the emperor whose reign began in 449 AD, and basically pushed the craven British aside, slaughtered them, or enslaved them. This is the story that's been repeated in history book after history book ever since the time of the Venerable Bede, because he's basically the only good historical source we have for that period. But did he know what he was writing about?
Or was he biased?
Or was he biased, exactly, as a good Angle himself, living in Northumbria in one of the English-speaking kingdoms?
There are these stories I gather fairly well documented of Boudica, for example, or there are various ways of pronouncing her name, I guess, mm-hmm. who, you know, took on the Roman legions and slaughtered them in great numbers until a tactical error led to her downfall.
She was no pushover. Right. Well, leaving that figure aside, there certainly were strong elements in the British post-Roman civilization who, again, either resisted or formed alliances with the incomers. And certain things were conceded, other things were made the subject of accommodation and assimilation. And so we have a sort of hybrid culture forming here in Britain from the start.
And what's the difference between the Angles and the Saxons, and why is it that we sort of leave out the Jutes and the Frisians? We don't talk about Anglo-Saxon, Jute, Frisian history.
Right, with, three hyphens in between or so? No. Well, the very term Anglo-Saxon is essentially a modern convenience. The people of that time did not speak of themselves as some sort of hyphenated conglomerate people. They thought of themselves as Angla. The equivalent for that is English, or Saxa, Saxons, or the Wicha, maybe in the West, or there were any number of different tribal allegiances and so forth during this rather confusing early period that occurred during what used to be called the Dark Ages because of our lack of documentary sources bearing on it. But there was this significant difference that the Angla and the Saxa, although they spoke dialects of the same language, which was referred to commonly as English during this period, the ancestor of our English, obviously, they came from different regions. They had different genealogies in terms of the line of kings and so forth, or chieftains, whom they traced in their paths. They were, in fact, rival peoples in many ways, not just cousins. So the story of the way in which the people of Anglian descent in Britain and the people of Saxon descent in England struggled against one another and then eventually consolidated into a single people with a single set of laws and a single king. This is basically the major theme or one of the major themes of Anglo-Saxon history as a whole.
How widely do they spread once they come into England? England is a fairly tall country, north to south.
Yes. Well, if you think of the Isle of Britain, it's a very tall country, north to south. So, again, when we speak of Anglo-Saxon England, that is a kind of modern convenience as well, because in the post-Roman period, there was no England. England had to be made, had to be invented by these peoples through this process of rivalry and consolidation. And this occurred, but it did not occur until about the 10th century. And at that time, the Vikings also had come into the picture, originally as ruthless raiders and reavers, and then as settlers who, once again, accommodated to the English, to the dominant culture, that is to say, in Britain, and accepted their religion, took on leading roles in both church and state, and were absorbed into a single, you could even call it an Anglo-Scandinavian England at this point, incorporating that important Norse element as
going
well.
Going up to, but not including, Scotland?
Yes, the boundaries of that kingdom now were actually very comparable to, not the same as, but very comparable to the boundaries of Roman Britain during the colonial period. And those boundaries are also very comparable to what we call England today.
Leaving out Wales also?
Leaving Wales to the side, exactly, which was part of Roman Britain but was not part of Anglo-Saxon England, and today is again what?
Standoffish.
Standoffish, exactly.
Can you say something about the religious beliefs prior to Christianity and the ones that sort of struggled against it in this region?
Right. This has been a subject of considerable interest in the critical literature, and it's a subject about which speculation is rife because, of course, we don't, by definition, have records, that is, written documentary records from these people themselves as to what the nature of their beliefs were or their religious practices. So there's a lot of educated guesswork involving archaeology and philology, both, in trying to recover what the core practices and beliefs were. I think myself, it's almost a misnomer to speak of the religion of the Angles and the Saxons before they were converted to Christianity, because it's not clear that they had a religion in the modern sense, though they had surely a variety of local religious practices perpetuated by custom from generation to generation. So there were certain deities, and we know the names of them because they are preserved linguistically through the records of the Christian period and up to the present time. So we know that they had gods for whom our days of the week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, are named. And this is evidently a practice that actually is not original to them, but was based upon the Roman practice of naming comparable days of the week after gods of their own pantheon. So there's, a process of adaptation here. But we know there were these gods. They called them Tju, Woden, Thunor, and Freya, or Freya, respectively.
And were they anthropomorphic? In other words, are these gods that seem to have human qualities that there were stories about, or we just don't know?
Well, I think it's safe to say, in general, there's a tendency for human beings to create gods in their own image. So there's definitely a process of anthropomorphism there. On the other hand, what distinguishes them, obviously, is that they are capable of things wildly beyond human powers. And the chief of them, in particular, Woden in Old English, Odin in Old Norse is the sort of shamanic god of inspiration and possession and movement between the world of the living and the world of the dead.
Do we have any archaeological remains, temples of Anglo-Saxon origins?
Again, the very word temple calls to mind either early Christianity mm-hmm. or the kinds of alternative religions to Christianity that Christianity was resisting in the ancient Mediterranean. So the answer is almost no remains of what can be called temples. There seems to be no real evidence of a priesthood among these people. Probably powerful persons served at the same time as religious leaders, as cult leaders. At any rate, there is one building, however, that has been excavated in Bedes, Northumbria. And this plausibly has been identified as a temple of the heathen period on the basis of its position within the settlement complex and the presence of a great number of ox skulls methodically deposited beside the foundations of that
building. And the significance of those would be implying some kind of strength and stability, or what do we know about ox skulls and their powers?
Sacrifice this is, then?
Well, they probably sacrificed oxen because they had them. They may have sacrificed other animals as well. But this was largely a cattle economy. A person's wealth then, as now in those rural areas, is measured by their number of animals, number of beasts. In those days, cattle principally. So for them to kill off surplus cattle periodically, doubtless in a cultic manner, in a religiously approved manner, in the fall in particular. This is a custom we find really all over Europe, where we deal with a pastoral economy of this kind.
Sure. I mean, even, you know, in biblical terms, in the Middle East, you see evidence of slaughtering sacrificial cows and sheep. How did the Christianization take place? Was it a pretty standard, flow from the from Rome, missionaries?
Well, we often speak of the conversion of Anglo-Saxon England as if this were starting from scratch through impetus from Rome. And frankly, this is the story that, again, the Venerable Bede told and would like us to have faith in. In fact, as we now know, the process was a very complex one. For one thing, Christianity was already the official religion of the Roman Empire during mm-hmm. the
as
later
it,
years.
As it occupied England.
So Christianity was practiced widely in Britain before the coming of the Angles and the Saxons. If you don't believe that the Brits, that is the progenitors of the Welsh of today, were either driven away or slaughtered, then Christianity was doubtless still practiced in Britain at the time when the Angles and Saxons, pagans themselves, unconverted peoples, came among them. So there were processes of accommodation there which doubtless paved the way for the missionary effort which then was launched from Rome. It was almost like a second colonizing uh-huh. effort, without the legions this time, to bring the influence of that Mediterranean region into Britain once again through the means of the church.
Do we start mm-hmm. to see architecture then, Christian churches in Anglo-Saxon form of some kind?
Yes, we do see archaeological evidence, through the whole period of this process, which was a gradual one. And, of course, all the early churches were built in wood, and so it's much harder to trace what was and what was not a religious building and so forth. Sometimes place names help us in this process, or historical documents that the monks themselves kept and the bishops kept from this period. So the process of the growth of Christianity in the island is something that can be much more readily documented through archaeology and through these written sources than the matter of, well, how did they worship before the Christians ever came on the scene?
More on Anglo-Saxon history when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Thou imbichlau riadun hilde dior, athelinga baron, alra twelve, woden cara quithan, ond kinning mainan, ward yid reckon, ond umwer sprecken. Echtodon erlshipper ont his ellen work dugudum damedon, swa het ye deva bith that mon his winnedrichten wardum herja, ferchtum freilja. Fana he forth shille of leech hammon laded werthen. Swa begnornedon yet a leida, hlaverdus hrira, harth yenaetas. Quaiden that I were a world kininga mana mildust and monthwarest, leidum leidust and lof yornust.
That's the ending of Beowulf. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is John Niles, professor of English, and we are talking about romancing the Anglo-Saxon past. Well, the language itself is such an interesting mixture. It sounds at times as if you're speaking German. Other times we hear things that sound a little bit like English, sometimes something more Scandinavian. Is the term Old English synonymous with Anglo-Saxon?
Well, some people use those two terms synonymously, Old English and Anglo-Saxon. I prefer to use the term Old English to refer to the language itself used, spoken, and written by these people in these early centuries before the presence of the Normans in England had transformed the language quite considerably. Other people, as I say, use them interchangeably. For me, the term Anglo-Saxon is best used with relation to the period, the historical period, Anglo-Saxon England, the arts of the period, Anglo-Saxon sculpture and so forth, the history and other aspects of the culture in general. And that term is distinct from Old English in encompassing also, of course, the Latinate culture of the church.
What do we have for Anglo-Saxon literature?
Well, Norman, we actually have a considerable amount. It seems as though once the English had accepted Christianity, they embraced monasticism and the Benedictine ideal of the Opus Dei, the production of God's work, exactly, whether in the fields or in the scriptorium. So there actually was a great number of manuscripts produced during this period, chiefly for devotional purposes, chiefly in Latin. But remarkably and precociously, the English also began at a relatively early date, earlier than any other European people, to use their own native language for many of the same purposes. So they became a bilingual society in terms of their written records.
Does it, however, tell us a lot about Anglo-Saxon culture if we're reading devotional texts?
Does it tell us much about it? Well, that's a very good question. In Latin, I would say very little, because the Latinate language of Christendom was meant to be fairly uniform wherever Christianity was practiced. Now, that, of course, is an exaggeration, but that was the intention.
That was the advantage of Latin.
Yes. On the other hand, as soon as English enters the equation, the ancestral heritage built into the language itself kicks in a way that transforms what is being said. That is, to me, what is so interesting about reading the literature of the period, all of which is filtered through Christian intelligences, and yet it contains in the bedrock of the language itself, as well as in all the attitudes that go with that, ancient habits of thought as well.
It sounds as if you're zeroing in on Beowulf right there, because it has all those, I take them to be conflicting values between the Christian and the pagan.
Well, you must have read that poem somewhere along the line or heard it.
Well, it's a wonderful poem.
In one of the very many excellent translations that are now available. I know you have done that, Norman, and you share with me a keen interest in this work. Again, this to me is exactly what makes it so fascinating, as well as the sheer verbal brilliance of the work and the depths of the human spirit that it explores, the fact that it is such a remarkable work of synthesis, bridging the native oral culture of the Anglo-Saxons and the ancestral wisdom that goes along with that, and the world of European Christianity with all of the attitudes, theological included, that are embraced in that.
And while that passage you read at the opening of the segment is in our ears, I'm wondering, can you go back to the lines you read in Old English from the ending of Beowulf? And give us some sense of the language we're hearing. I mean, I got an A in Old English, but that was a long time ago in graduate school. And trying to hear the words that you're reading and sort of take them apart, that's difficult to do it just hearing it once. Can you go back to it and give us a sense of this language and its richness?
Well, good, Emily. I'm glad you, too, are such a student of the language and the literature of the period, and I'm sure you fully deserve that A.
I remember almost none of it. The problem is it's difficult to find Old English speakers today.
It is, and that is why it's a little... I feel comfortable in reading the language out loud because there's no one out there
who
told me I've done it wrong exactly. It's just a question of sounding confident and authoritative.
Well, let's face it, there was probably more than one way of pronouncing it anyway over the course of even 100 years.
Absolutely. The language of Beowulf is a composite of special poetic language, and people living in the north, people living in the southwest, people of educated status or of lower status would have sounded it out differently, perhaps, from the very beginning. At any rate, to go back to your question, Emily, the verse itself has a highly rhythmic element to it, which is based upon a four-stress pattern per what we call line, though the very idea of a line of poetry is a visual one. And in essence, what I'm talking about is rhythm, a rhythmic pulse, not a linear symmetry of some kind. So we have four discernible stresses. Tha umba hlau riadan hilda deora athalinga barn Alra 12. I think you can hear it. Two and two, with any number of unstressed syllables divided by pauses which are of greater or less distinction. Now, added to that strongly pronounced four-stress rhythm, though, is the key element from a formal perspective of alliteration. And I think you can hear it, though it is sometimes a subtle effect, not as heavy a one as you find in some modern translations of the verse.
Which is probably a good thing. Over the course of, 6,000 lines, you wouldn't want it to be constantly knocking you on the head.
I think you're quite right about that, and I could illustrate that principle with a few lines quoted from an English poet's translation of the poem known as The Battle of Brunanburh. This is Alfred Lord Tennyson's version of that work, and the translation reads like this. Athelstan King, Lord among Earls, Bracelet Bestower and Baron of Barons, he with his brother Edmund Atheling, gaining a lifelong glory in battle. It goes on like that. He brake the shield wall, hewed the linden wood, hacked the battle shield. Sons of Edward with hammered brands. It's glorious in its own way, but very heavy-handed compared with the subtle rhythms and subtle, more subtle alliterations of the Old English.
And the part that you just read there from Beowulf, what were you saying?
I'll paraphrase rather than give you a full translation at this point. I read that part of the poem which consists of a funeral eulogy for the dead King Beowulf, who has given his life for his people, exactly, sacrificing himself in combat against a truly formidable adversary, a flying fire drake, fire-breathing poisonous dragon. So there's this fabulous element incorporated into the plot, and yet the ending obsequies for the hero are quite sober, and one can relate to them as with any funeral ceremony at the end. Then about the barrow, the king's funeral barrow, there rode the ones keen in battle, the sons of noblemen, 12 out of all. And it is told they wished to give vocal expression to their grief at the death of their king, praise his deeds of courage as it is fitting that one honor his lord after his death. So, to paraphrase the last lines, the people of the Yeatas, the king's tribe, lamented the death of their lord, their hearth companions. They said that he had been, of all worldly kings, the most merciful of men and the most gracious, the most kind to his people, and the most eager for fame.
And what do we lose if we leave behind the Old English? I mean, for you, when you read it in the original, in the Old English, what special quality does it have that you lose in any translation?
Well, to put it simply, you lose the poetry that makes this poem such an extraordinary expression, not just of the Anglo-Saxons, but of the human spirit universally. To me, that's a grievous loss.
Inevitable in any translation.
Inevitable in any translation, true enough. So what can I say but that I can admire any number of translations of the poem, but only the original words have the power of bringing tears to one's eyes.
Concepts that don't translate from Old English to English very well, where it's really hard to take a word-for-word translation?
Well, it would be rubbish. It would be nonsense to translate the work word for word, if you mean word in the modern sense. But here's an example of the differences that exist between the old language and the new. The very word word in Old English, pronounced ward, doesn't mean what you and I think of as a word, something in the dictionary. It means an utterance. An utterance.
Mm-hmm. So actually a vocal word.
Yes, a vocal word. And words in the society are like material things. You give someone your word, it's like handing the person something hard that they can hold and keep. You see, there's an honor about that and a gravity about it, potentially, that we do not today normally associate with our utterances.
And Beowulf falls where in terms of the Anglo-Saxon arc of history?
Well, there, Norman, you've hit upon a very touchy point for the specialists. What we can say with confidence in terms of where the poem falls within this scope of Anglo-Saxon history is it's preserved in one unique manuscript written down, like other Old English poetry, about the year 1000 by two scribes, neither of whom was particularly competent. So I think it is fair to say that our knowledge of the poem and the language in which it is written is actually superior in many ways to that of the scribes who wrote it down. That may be paradoxical, but I think it's true.
But written down pretty late in the Anglo-Saxon history. Then.
Fairly late within that span of history that we've outlined. Not that long before 1066 and the political end to Anglo-Saxon England. On the other hand, the roots of the poetry go way, way back, obviously. The verse form that I've described is a common Germanic verse form. It's one that evidently the Angles and the Saxons brought with them in their movements from the continent to the island of Britain. So the very words and expressions, the formulas of the poetry, may have a great antiquity about them.
What about music? I mean, a lot of there's always this link, you know, between poetry and song. Mm-hmm. What's known about music?
We know nothing at all about how this text might have been performed. We can only guess as to whether it was performed in one or another version before being fossilized in a hard text in this form. We don't know if the poem once written down was read privately, read aloud, sounded out musically. All of these are viable possibilities. So there's plenty of room for the professors to get to work on these questions.
The one practitioner that I know of who actually does it in Old English, Benjamin Bagby,
yes,
who has actually come to Wisconsin,
yes,
performs with a modern equivalent of a harp that was excavated where? Was it at Sutton Hoo or where?
Actually, the one that he uses is one for which real wooden remains have been recovered. And this is from Trossingen in the area of the Schwarzwald in Germany. But there are, I think, maybe even a dozen or so sets of remains of such instruments, comparable instruments, harp or lyre, whatever you want to call them, from different grave sites in Europe and at Sutton Hoo as well.
You mentioned that, or we mentioned at the top of the hour, that you're the president of the International Society of Anglo-Saxonists, and you've talked about specialists and professors in this area. But any, I don't know, would you venture to make a claim about characteristics of those who are enamored with this period? Do you think King Arthur is partly the draw for many in terms of the avenue in?
Absolutely not.
No.
No. Well, maybe. Of course, we all have read or been read stories of Arthur as children, and that is part of romancing the period, I think, ultimately. But as soon as you begin to have the least scholarly understanding of the period, you realize that whatever Arthur represents, it's a wonderful mythic creation, which is a story of its own. And there are plenty of other scholars who have become passionate about that and have entered Arthurian studies like a marvelous enchanted wood and have often never come out the other side.
Well, speaking of coming out the other side, we'll find out what happened after 1066, that celebrated date in English history, and how the Anglo-Saxons live on when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, John Niles, and with him we are romancing the Anglo-Saxon era. If we're going to be romancing the Anglo-Saxon era, Jack, I have to say that, it would be really all over in 1066 when that next invasion strikes Britain. What led up to that event, and why were the Normans successful against the Anglo-Saxons?
Big questions indeed. I think what you need to know about England during that period before 1066 is that the nation had been formed, one that's, as we've said, very comparable in certain ways to the England of today. And it was a going concern. The economy was working. There was a surplus of wealth. And it was a well-organized realm by this time, thanks in part to the assimilation of the Scandinavian elements that I've referred to before, which gave the country a certain backbone, perhaps, that it might not otherwise have had. The problem was that Edward, the confessor, we call him, a pious man, seems to have lived a celibate life. At any rate, he was dedicated to the church, and he died without an heir.
That's a serious drawback for a king.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. This created a potential serious problem when he died in his advanced old age in the late days of the year 1065. And we know that there was some nervousness about the succession at this point, because within a day, before the body was even decently cold, Harold Godwinson, the most powerful magnate of the realm of the area of Wessex, the traditional heartland in the southern part of England, was crowned king. It was an extraordinary example of haste or precipitousness.
He was not directly related to Edward? He was not really in line for the throne?
He could claim a relationship, a blood relationship, but it was a tenuous one. And in addition, Edward himself had been brought up in Normandy because of his need to be in exile during the time of his youth. So he did not even come into England until he was a mature adult. And he came with a number of Norman followers in his entourage. He established a cosmopolitan realm in which continental influence was quite pronounced.
So he
had allies. He had established allies among the Normans.
So he's already more Norman than Saxon, it sounds like.
I wouldn't say more Norman than Saxon, because he had to assume a strong English identity upon becoming king.
And are the
but
Normans
these were his roots?
And are the Normans speaking a sort of old French?
Yes, their own dialect again of French at this time, Norman French. He would have been, of course, conversant with Latin and with English and French equally. Harold was much more of the down-home Englishman, and his party had little need or patience for the Normans who had been so important in Edward's court. Well, you can see the grounds of conflict here, particularly since it was claimed by a succession of Norman apologists and historiographers that Edward had promised the succession to William, Duke of Normandy, who had again a blood connection to the English royal line, though it was again somewhat tenuous. We don't know the truth of that claim, but they asserted it with vehemence, and William seems to have believed that he was the chosen successor.
And what actually happened at the Battle of Hastings?
Well, again, the events of 1066 were momentous and absolutely unprecedented in English history, because there were three claimants to the throne. So we're not dealing with a dual situation here, Harold versus William.
It's a free-for-all.
But a free-for-all, a real Donnybrook here, with Harald Sigurdarson, the king of Norway, in the picture as well. He, too, had an argument for a legitimate claim to the throne through the intermarriages that had occurred earlier during the time of King Canute, the Danish king.
So what does Harald do about it?
Yes.
Well... Does he come down too? Yes,
so Harold began preparing to claim his own in Britain. And there had been traditionally a strong Scandinavian influence, particularly in the northeastern parts of Britain. So there was a way in which perhaps if these people had sat around a conference table and dealt, they might have divided things up. Wessex to Harold, London and its environments to William, right? And York in the north to Harald of Norway. But did they do that? Of course not. They
winner
were going to
all.
Fight it out.
And so Harald of Norway, invades in the northeast?
Yes. The first thing that happened, let's put the events of the year in order. In 1066, the English knew from early on that the French were planning to mount a major invasion. But this was not, either then or now, an easy thing for anyone to do. How do you get your heavily armed troops with their horses and so forth safely across the channel, establish a beachhead in a hostile region, and then advance to the interior? This was a major proposition, and the army kept taking time to build up its forces on the French shore, and Harold kept waiting and waiting. In the meantime, Harald of Norway struck in the north, landed in the area of York, and began gathering his horses and food there. So Harald Godwinson, with his men on a forced march, went to the north in September of 1066, and there evidently came upon a Harald of Norway by surprise, and in a decisive battle, Harald of Norway was killed with many of his troops at the Battle of Stamford Bridge.
But then there's this matter of the commute.
But the commute. Yes, when your militia have gone home for the harvest, when your elite troops are far in the north, that's a golden moment for William to advance across the channel on a favorable day, which he did, and not only established a beachhead unopposed, but began foraging and ravaging in the surrounding countryside, establishing a very powerful base, which then Harald Godwinson had to come back to attack. So the Normans had a certain strategic advantage, you could say, even in that hostile land, on the eve of the Battle of Hastings.
And what difference did the conquest make to the people sort of on the ground? And, you know, looking ahead at the few years after that.
To all those Anglo-Saxons. You
know. Right. Well, good question, Emily. Really, the question for the common man was not, are we going to be paying our taxes or not, but who's collecting them at the other end? And you can be almost indifferent to that if the amount you're paying is essentially the same. So these momentous matters chiefly affected the destinies of the higher-ranking members of society, but it affected them profoundly. And this is where the question of Anglo-Saxon identity comes in, because you didn't cease speaking English or being an Anglo-Saxon, as we call them now, just because a battle was won at Stamford Bridge and then lost at Hastings. On the contrary, the language has a tremendous momentum and inertia of its own over time. We still speak the language with many transformations that was spoken then. But political power changed to such a dramatic extent that within two generations or so of the conquest, all of the leading magnates of the realm, essentially, and leading figures in the church were directly allied with the incoming Norman-French contingent.
What was the cultural result of that in terms of you have Norman-French then becoming the legal language of the land, the language of government, mm-hmm. the language, I assume, of culture? Hasn't Anglo-Saxon ever since had kind of a shadowy reputation? You sometimes say, instead of pardon my French, pardon my Anglo-Saxon. It seems that a lot of the Anglo-Saxon words don't have quite the cachet. For example, we say supper would be much less formal than dinner, which is the more French, mm-hmm. Norman-French sort of word. And then there are any number, I mean, pork versus swine and all kinds of things. The polite word still seems to be the one that came over with the Norman French.
Absolutely. And this is an element that can be parodied or satirized readily, the French culture being thought of as being more effete, out of touch with the nitty-gritty realities of the field and so forth. On the other hand, you could see this as, in essence, a beneficial process in the long term for the people residing in Britain, because, again, these same processes of amalgamation, accommodation, hybridization took place, and Britain, instead of being a rather remote outpost of Europe, was integrated in a much more cosmopolitan scene as a result of the Norman conquest. So you can see the result of this in architecture in particular, wonderful productions of physical grandeur in the ecclesiastical and civil architecture of this period, and bookmaking as well. The great age of English bookmaking was that after the Norman conquest, not before.
How much of modern English is Anglo-Saxon based?
Well, if you look at the whole of the great vocabulary of English, The sources are, they're so numerous you can scarcely count them, and the French element is very distinct in that. On the other hand, if you look at the most commonly used 100 words in English, they're almost all Anglo-Saxon.
And if it tends to be a down-to-earth word like work or dirt, tends to be Anglo-Saxon, right?
Yes, though your ears can mislead you also, Emily, in that regard, in that some French words, too, have been embedded in the language so long that they sound native to our ears, even though a linguist will tell you they are not.
You have a conference coming up and an exhibit. Can you say a little bit about that and what the draw is today for people looking at Anglo-Saxon history?
Yes, just this summer, beginning the 31st of July and continuing through the first week of August, the International Society of Anglo-Saxonists will be meeting here in Madison. We're hosting that organization here after other meetings that have taken place in such cities as London, Helsinki, Munich, other parts of the world. So somewhat more than 100 specialists in this subject will be coming from a number of different countries, and some are historians, some archaeologists or art historians. A number of them deal with the language and the literature as a specialty, as I do myself. But it's a wonderfully diverse set of talents and of perspectives that are brought together in a society like this. And we're privileged in having these leading scholars and a number of junior scholars as well and graduate students in the field coming here to Madison this summer.
And the library is doing some sort of exhibit in conjunction?
The library is, yes. The library is putting on an exhibit called Reflections of Anglo-Saxon England in the Department of Special Collections on the ninth floor of Memorial Library, so that those people coming to the conference can see something of what the remarkable resources are of our great library in terms of publications in this general area, ranging from the scholarly to the popular impressions of Anglo-Saxon England over the centuries. So that's something that anyone in the region is warmly invited to come and take a look at, if possible, in the Special Collections Room of Memorial Library.
Final question. When the Norman French took over England, is it true that after a couple of hundred years, they pretty much forgot how to speak Norman French and wound up speaking English? I mean, in Parliament, wasn't the official language for maybe a couple of hundred years Norman French? But finally, at one point, they said, we're not speaking it anymore. Let's just speak English.
Well, who were the Normans at this point, exactly?
Pretty well blended in.
Absolutely. Again, as with so many conquests, it's the same story, very often of intermarriage from an early state, where warriors, members of a warrior aristocracy, are given lands, and they may bring wives from home. But then again, there may be reasons, personal or political, for them to intermarry with the native population. And the children of such marriages generally adopt as their mother tongue the maternal language, not the paternal language. They will be often bilingual, they need to be in that cosmopolitan situation. But very soon you find a decided preference for the use of the English language among as generations passed. So that happened in England. It was only a matter of time then until English should reassert itself as a language of common discourse.
You can think of England as a great sponge, just absorbing whatever comes in.
Wonderful image, isn't it? Exactly. And I think it's typical of many parts of the world in that regard. Exactly. It's all added into a great rich amalgam to which we in America also have a distinct relation as well.
Well, Jack, come back. It's been a fascinating hour, a great pleasure.
Thank you, Norman, and thank you, Emily.
Our guest has been John Niles, professor of English, and we've been talking about romancing the Anglo-Saxon past. I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.